Hey y'all, I'm Dan, and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Coving.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case we have for you today is one that has been on our radar for years, one that actually takes us out of West Virginia. It's a case about a 15-year-old girl that disappeared after only attending half of her classes in the quiet town of Spanish Fork, Utah. This is the case of Kiplin Davis. Kiplin Davis was born on July 1st, 1979, to Tamara and Richard Davis, with two older siblings, a sister named Haley and a brother named Rory, a younger sister named Carissa, who I've actually got to have a few conversations with, and I absolutely love her. The family lived in Spanish Fork, Utah, which is one of the many communities surrounding Utah Lake, and located south of Provo in the northern half of the state. Kiplin loved theater and dance, and she was part of her school's theater department. Actually, at the time of her disappearance, she was assisting with the props for the department's upcoming production of Foreigner. One thing that I have to talk about is that in her missing persons report, it included the detail that she was often self-conscious about her appearance.
It just makes you wow, like it said that. In it.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know, but I do know that her classmates and teachers all said that she was a very well put together person. She was a girl's girl. I mean, she loved to have her hair and makeup done. One thing that I've learned is that she had this striking, precocious sense of self. Even for a 15-year-old, like her family remembers that she was once asked, if you could be anyone in the world, who would you be?
Who did she say?
She said, I'd like to be me. I can't think of anyone I'd rather be than myself. I mean, Kiplin was a normal, well-behaved teenager. But like any teenager, she did have conflicts with her parents, including a debate over whether or not she would be allowed to date.
I mean, I know it's like a normal thing when you ask that you can start dating. I mean, I actually had the rule that I couldn't start dating until I was 16. But I don't understand why the need for the big debate.
Well, I mean, kind of like your parents. Kiplin's parents wouldn't let her date till she was 16. But even though she wasn't allowed to date, she did get the attention from some boys at school. She's been asked out multiple times in the months leading up to her disappearance. So it's, I guess, really rough for Kiplin because her parents had the strict rule and she felt like she was ready to take that big step and start dating.
I mean, I know sometimes you feel like you're ready to start dating. I think a lot of times it's like you want to fit in and everything. But at the same time, I see red flags in this when just a few months before she went missing, boys are randomly asking her out and she's grabbing the attentions of boys from school and things of that nature. And I mean, it just kind of makes you wonder on that front.
Right. On Tuesday, May 2nd, 1995, she woke up much earlier than usual at 4:30 a.m.
That is early.
Yeah, and the reason she woke up so early is she wanted to take her driver's educational class. And I'm not sure if it's like driver's ed or not. I kind of feel like if it's that early in the morning, you wouldn't want kids on the road driving a vehicle. Or if it was just like a different class, like something at the DMV or something like that. But, I mean, good for her, because in 2 months she would be 16 and she would have her driver's license by then. And I guess you could say she was like me when she woke up.
She hit that snooze button, didn't she?
She did. She was like, let me get 30 more minutes of sleep. Which, y'all, I have like a short tangent here. But I set an alarm around Courtney one time and she was like, oh my God, I am fully concerned for you, with the amount of alarms I had set.
Yeah, I just don't even comprehend. Like, I looked over and I said, how many alarms do you have set? And he was like, not that many. And I was like, not that many. We have five. We have 5:05. We have 5:10. We have 5:15. Literally, like, every 5 minutes, there's an alarm mm-hmm. set.
Yeah, and, like, it's funny you say that, because I counted them the other day, like, when I was typing this up, and I now have 50 alarms in my phone.
It's so ridiculous.
Which I use them for, like, all different times, because, like, sometimes I have to wake up at 2 a.m. for work. Sometimes I have to wake up at 3, 4, 5.
So it starts going off at 2 o'clock.
2:45, 2:50, 3:20, 3:30 when I have to get out the door.
Do you know how many alarms I have?
Probably like one.
Two.
Must be nice. Anyway, she did hit the snooze button, and that's when her dad came in to make sure she was awake. Not wanting to function that early, she pleaded with her dad to allow her to miss just one class, but he said no. Richard remembers Kipling saying that she was frustrated because she wouldn't have time to do her hair and makeup before class, but he maintained that she needed to follow through with her commitment so she could get her driver's license that summer. Following her dad's orders, she quickly got ready, and when her mom drove her to school, she noticed that Kipling was crying, but she kind of just assumed that she was tired and frustrated with the argument she had with her dad.
Did she ask her why she was crying?
Sadly, no, and I guess it, like, bothers her so much because that was the last time she saw Kipling.
Kipling attended her driver's ed class, and then she headed to school afterwards, as usual. But when her dad arrived home for the day hours later, around 3:30 p.m., he was honestly confused because there was a voicemail from Kipling's school informing them that she hadn't shown up for her fourth period class or any of her classes after lunch. He was immediately concerned, just knowing that Kipling wasn't the person who would just skip out on school, especially considering that she was already there and she had attended her morning classes.
So really the question is, like, where did she go after lunch and why?
Or did she by chance let anyone know where she was going?
I'm going to say no, because she would typically call home and be like, hey, I'm going to do this, but she didn't even do that. And I mean, she really had no reason not to call because the Davis family had cell phones, which in 1995, that's a huge deal. And if she would have gotten into trouble somehow or needed a ride, she could have easily gotten in contact with her parents.
So no one heard from her whatsoever.
Yeah, so really all that her mom and dad could do is just sit around with this increasing sense of panic, waiting for Kipling to get home or at least finally call and let them know where she was.
Around 5 p.m., when she hadn't done either of these things, they started to call around to her friends just in hopes of trying to find out what happened at lunch or if anyone has seen her or possibly was she at a friend's house hanging out. But strangely, no one had any information to offer the Davises. So her parents decided to head to Spanish Fork High School to look for themselves.
Here's what they found. All of Kipling's belongings were left in her school locker.
Which, in all honesty, that's not normal.
Exactly.
It's kind of like she dropped off all of her stuff and then just vanished.
But why would she? If she was going somewhere, why wouldn't she take her stuff? Also, no one at school had seen her. The interesting thing is that if she did leave all of those things behind in her locker, it kind of feels clear to me that she was going somewhere during lunch, and then she planned on coming back to school so she could finish up her day.
I mean, it makes sense to leave all that stuff in her locker if she's like going off campus for lunch and don't want to carry some of the stuff with her.
Yeah. So after looking around the school and questioning different people, around 7 p.m., her parents called the police to report their 15-year-old daughter missing. Sadly, the Spanish Fork Police Department downplayed her disappearance, telling her family that she was likely a runaway. Still, police did issue a bolo, which I can't even imagine how much that would frustrate them because they tried to look on their own right before going to the police.
And you know what the sad part is? This is so common in so many cases. Police are like, okay, you guys are freaking out right now, but she'll probably be home soon.
Yeah, which is like no comfort at all. They're like, okay, well, she's been missing all day and we don't know where she is.
Yeah, like that's no comfort to the family whatsoever.
Yeah, so what I love about the Davises is that they refuse to just sit around and wait. Her family took matters into their own hands again, and that very night, printing out hundreds of flyers and posting them around the city, just hoping to spread awareness with her information and picture.
And you know what? Major props to them for not wasting any time to getting her info out.
1,000%. I know some families just sit back and wait, and I'm like, let's, you know, get information out there. If no one else is searching, like, why not us? But one thing that stood out to me is that her dad had this sickening feeling that Kipling was dead. He couldn't stop crying. He couldn't even explain why he was feeling that way.
You know, it's so crazy. Honestly, I think it's like an intuition that people have and things like that. There's just some things you know.
Possibly. Which, I mean, that's why they're looking, because they both felt like something was extremely wrong.
So, her family continued to spread the word that evening. They finally spoke to someone who had information to offer them. So, this is like the first big tip that led them down a rabbit hole. Her mom spoke with Kipling's friend, Eli, who claimed that he had last seen her at lunch that day, where she had been practicing a dance with another member of the theater department, a teen named Chris Jepson.
According to Eli, it seemed like Kipling was enamored with him as they danced together, like maybe she had a little crush on Chris. So desperate for more leads, her parents looked into Kipling's journals and noticed Chris's name was mentioned multiple times. And Eli actually said that he last saw Kipling leaving school with Chris.
Did he ever know where they were going or mentioned it?
Sadly, no. Chris was on the stage crew for the upcoming play and was working lighting. Kipling was working backstage as well, so they spent a lot of time together. In one of her journal entries, she said that she hugged and even kissed Chris, despite her parents' wishes that she would wait until she was 16. With this information, her parents went to Chris's home, hoping that they could get more information from him, since at that point it seemed like he was the last person she was seen with. When they got to his house, his sister entered the door and claimed that she was the only one home. She did say that he attended a full day of school, then stayed late after school to run lights for rehearsal, which is where he could be found.
He was still there that late at night?
You know, I thought the same thing. Like, I guess rehearsals could kind of run late. So, Richard went back to the school between 10 and 10:30. As you can imagine, the school was empty, and Richard didn't believe that many people, if anyone at all, was still there. So her parents continued to drive around Spanish Fork late into the evening, just hoping for any answer. Around 1 a.m. with no sign of Chris, they decided to drive back to his house again, wondering if maybe they would be able to see him.
So did they?
No, but they did notice a light on in one room that they thought just might be his bedroom. There was also a truck parked out front, which that wasn't there hours before. And this truck actually belonged to 18-year-old David Levinson, who went by his middle name Rucker. Her dad found this to be suspicious, that the boys seemed to be hanging out and that they were awake so late into the night, which 1 a.m. on a school night is super late. Not wanting to disturb his parents, Richard decided to wait until the morning to try and talk to him again. In an interview, Richard said, quote, "It's one of those values that you hold, that you don't disturb people after 10 o'clock at night. That's their private time. They could have been in bed and I thought I better not knock," end quote. And later, he defended his decision by saying, quote, "We were the ones doing the investigation. The police weren't. And we're amateurs. We don't know what we're doing. We've never had a daughter missing before. So we don't know the procedure that you go through," end quote.
I mean, why anyone would give him any...
Yeah, I mean, how we know how people treat a grieving family member. And, you know, they want to say, "I would do this, I would do that, I would do this different, I would do that different. I would knock on the door, I would knock down the door." But honestly, you don't know what you're going to do until you're in that moment.
Exactly. And I have to ask this question. What do we know about Rucker?
Well, his reputation at school was pretty mixed. Like, according to some students, he could be a bit of a bully. He enjoyed parking his oversized truck in the student parking lot and showing it off. But on the other hand, and this may shock you like it did me, he was a theater devotee with many friends in the program, including Kiplin and Chris. His family and Kiplin's family actually used to go to the same church, and Richard, who owned and operated a construction company, did some remodeling for Rucker's family's house. And he actually remembers Kiplin and Rucker getting along well when he was working on their home.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
The morning after Kiplin's disappearance, Wednesday, May 3rd, 1995, her parents continued to push for assistance from the police, and they managed to enlist the help of the police department's school resource officer, Morgan Warren. The next day, Morgan addressed Kiplin's disappearance with every single class in Spanish for Kai. He was suspicious of Chris from the jump. Chris was this apathetic student with frequent absences who didn't seem to care about his presence there. So again, Morgan is very suspicious of him. He pulled Chris out of his social studies to speak with him.
He admitted, just like Eli said, that he was dancing with Kiplin during their lunch the previous day.
So he's not hiding that it was true.
Yeah, he said, "We're dancing, we're practicing. I did see her at lunch." But here's the thing. Chris maintained that he did return to class after lunch to finish out his afternoon like usual. And he did stay after school for rehearsal, and he hadn't seen Kiplin since. He explained that he had been in the auditorium until around 11 o'clock that night, which means that he would have been there when her parents went back to school at 10 p.m. He said that he had help from Rucker, which is who they spotted at his home, and another kid named Timmy Olson.
Do we know if he was telling the truth or not?
I mean, honestly, no. Because, I mean, her parents didn't go into the school, so we have no idea. I mean, they didn't see any vehicles there, so I mean, I guess it could be like a TBD situation. Rucker and Timmy claimed that they had a ride back at school between 7 and 8 p.m. to meet Chris, where the three boys threw around a football around the auditorium and then left the school around 11 p.m. Officer Morgan actually suspected the boys' involvement in Kiplin's disappearance and presumed that Chris, if not all three of them, were lying. but he was unable to prove it, so he was forced to drop it for the time being.
Why did they force him to drop it?
I think it was because another student pointed to Brandon Myers, who reportedly had a crush on Kipling, and he asked her out before she went missing. Kipling apparently had the same feelings towards him because she said yes to a date.
So, when did Brandon ask her?
You know, I'm not too sure what day it was, but I do know that he asked her if she was free that coming Friday when she finished on Tuesday, and they agreed that they would have their first date then. But it did turn out that it was kind of a moot point, because Brandon rescinded his offer that Monday, the day before her disappearance, saying that he had already been seeing someone and that, you know, things had kind of been getting more serious.
I'm not going to lie, I'm a little aggravated right now about that, because if he was seeing somebody else, why would he ask Kipling out on a date?
Honestly, I'm not too sure, but according to Brandon, he remained at school for the rest of the day after she went missing, none the wiser that anything was wrong with her. But when investigators double-checked his school records, it turned out that he missed the rest of the day just like her. And you'll never believe this, but he asked a girl that he'd been seeing if she could gain access to the attendance office and change his record for him, but she told him that she couldn't.
Well, that's not suspicious at all.
Right, and you would have to be an office aide to even be able to go into there. At least I
and
think.
Honestly, I mean, I'm not trying to sound dumb or nothing, but how in the world would you be able to get a hold of the records to change it?
Exactly. I do know that Brandon told investigators that he felt guilty about canceling their date and said that he stopped in on his fourth period class briefly and then left to go find Kipling in order to apologize to her. Which is weird because he canceled their date the day before, so why did he feel like he needed to, like, go find her during class?
Like, none of this is adding up.
Yeah, like, it's really convenient timing, and the whole, like, hey, can you change this so no one knows how to miss my classes? I mean, it's a little suspicious still. Brandon said that when he couldn't find Kipling, he decided to skip the rest of the day, which is kind of weird because he was like, well, I can't find Kipling, so screw the rest of school.
So weird.
Right?
But then, you know what he said afterwards? That he got a flat tire on his way home and that he had to call his friend to come out and help him. But when police talked to his friend, he was confused because he said Brandon's account wasn't true, that he didn't help him that day with his flat tire. If you're going to ask for an alibi or say that you have an alibi, make sure that they're clued in.
Literally, like, we know, like, I would be like,
yes.
Hey, court, I'm doing this. Go and do this if anyone asks you.
100%. I got you.
We're like Marianne and Wanda. I mean, literally.
Literally. But without any other indications that Brandon was involved with what happened to Kipling, they weren't getting any valuable information whatsoever from him. So even though it was weird that he missed half of his classes that day, that he went looking for Kipling, he lied about a flat tire. He continued to maintain his innocence despite being caught in a lie.
Which, get this, Officer Morgan claimed that he didn't actually suspect Brandon's involvement.
Why's that?
Despite confusing some details, which could have possibly been an honest mistake, his story didn't change. By August, 3 months later, the FBI teamed up with the local police to aid in the investigation into Kipling's disappearance. With no new information from the three teenage boys believed to be the last people to see her, the case went cold. About a year after she went missing, Chris randomly stopped by the Davis's house to speak with Richard. Without claiming responsibility or just offering any new information, Chris simply said that he was sorry that Kipling disappeared and wanted to reassure her parents that he had nothing to do with it.
I swear, I'm so frustrated because I can tell you this much about people who lie. I call it liaria because that's the only thing that you can do is constantly lie. And with my job, I have caught so many people in lies that, like, they're so good at lying. their story will not change. They are able to repeat that story just like that. And I feel that this is going on in her parents. God bless them, because I would be infuriated myself if somebody came up to me and was like, oh, by the way, I didn't have nothing to do with it, but I'm sorry about your daughter's disappearance. And it just makes me think, how did Richard feel about this?
Like, his unexpected visit was reeked of guilt, and he couldn't figure out what the purpose or why he was even there. Chris, who was also Mormon, was headed out on his mission soon. They felt like maybe he wanted to alleviate his guilt before he left. He also admitted and apologized for once being mean to Kipling, telling her parents that he handcuffed her to the stairs at school with a pair of prop handcuffs from their department.
What in a million years would make somebody want to do that?
I have no idea, but in an interview with the FBI, he said, quote, I was an ass in high school. I felt guilty for the way that I talked to Kipling. It affected me so bad, end quote. When the Davises told police about this, they found it odd as well. So they decided to grill the boys, suspecting that they knew more than they were telling.
Per usual, how did that work out?
I mean, Chris, Rucker, and Timmy were all adamant that they weren't involved. That they actually offered to undergo polygraph tests.
Which we all know that that don't mean nothing.
Right, but they all did just that. They spoke with Chris first, and to their surprise, he passed. And for some unknown reason, Timmy began to offer up more information unprovoked by the detectives.
So, meaning what?
Like, during the written portion of the polygraph, he admitted to seeing Kipling outside of school on the day that she disappeared.
Like, could he have possibly meant he seen her before school?
I mean, yeah. But he also said that he and Rucker had taken Kipling to Spanish Fort Canyon in Rucker's truck during what was supposed to be their fourth period, which neither he nor Rucker had ever told that to police before.
So, just like a year after her disappearance, they just dropped this huge bomb.
Yeah, like, it's insane. So, Timmy explained everything. He said that he watched as Kipling and Rucker walked away from the truck and went over to the ridge of the canyon out of sight. And you want to know what happened next?
They returned?
Well, only half of that. Only Rucker returned to the truck. And when Timmy asked what happened, Rucker told him not to worry about it, and the boys left without her. Investigators were just as shocked that Timmy had willingly offered up this info. Which, it's also weird because he's saying, we did see her after what he originally said, and we took her here, and then we left her here.
My gut is saying there is more to this story than what is being told.
Oh, 100%. But here's the thing. When he was asked for more information, he just panicked and crinkled up the paper that he had written the statement on, saying he wanted a lawyer before excusing himself from the interrogation room.
Mm-mm-mm. You don't lawyer up unless you know something. Or unless you did something, you do not lawyer up.
Exactly. And I think that was like his old moment. What have I done?
Absolutely it was. So at this point, the police, their minds are blown like mine is right now. And they suspected his and Rucker's involvement in Kipling's disappearance. And likely death even more than before, but they weren't able to detain him. Police spoke to the third member of this little crew, Rucker, and guess what? He also passed a polygraph, just like Chris did, which kind of called Timmy's account of the thing into question, because it's like, Chris and Rucker passed on paper, according to the test. It doesn't seem like they're being as deceptive Like, they're lying about not being involved in Kipling's disappearance.
Police now know that they need to pay extra attention to Tammy. During the summer of 1996, after the polygraphs and a year after Kipling went missing, police continued to work on their case against the boys. Chris Rucker and some friends one night gathered for a movie night.
Which is a normal thing for friends to do.
I mean, I guess you could say that. But this movie night, it's said that Rucker reportedly raped a young female and later lied about it, leading to one of the many counts of perjury. The following summer, 1997, Rucker and Timmy became engaged in a public shouting match on Spanish Forks Main Street. Rucker had, apparently had enough with the rumors that Timmy was spreading around town that Rucker was responsible for Kipling's disappearance.
It's really weird to me. Timmy said all this stuff into, the polygraph and the written portion and everything. And it's suspicious that he's going around saying all this because we know our boy Timmy, he's sus.
Yeah, I mean, all of these boys are sus, but, Timmy's the one with the big-ass mouth.
I mean, only thing that comes to my mind is he is desperate to get this information, attention and everything off of him. He don't want that attention on himself anymore.
Exactly, which we know many guilty people do. According to court documents, Rucker was yelling at the top of his lungs during this incident, and he even said that if there were no other cars on the main street, he would kill Timmy on the spot, threatening to retrieve a gun to do so. So Rucker apparently also told multiple friends that he had committed what he called the ultimate crime, but offered no context.
God. It's a waiting game. The police are stuck in this game with the three that they felt were guilty.
Yeah, and I couldn't have said it any better myself.
As police work to find a culprit or culprits in order to put this painful ordeal behind them and to focus on memorializing Kipling, her family made the very difficult decision to have her legally declared dead. And I can't even begin to imagine the pain and agony that they went through making that decision to do that. Because at that given point, when you do that, you know all hope is gone that you're ever going to see your child alive again. And so 4 years after her disappearance, her friends and family held a memorial service and they erected a grave with her name and picture in their local Spanish Fork City Cemetery, which they hope to eventually use for Kipling's remains whenever they find them. Her father, Richard, hoped that the anniversary would speak a renewed effort. Kipling's father hoped that the anniversary would spark a renewed effort into her case. He pleaded with the public and those who may know something around town, including the parents and families of those who are believed to be involved. He said in an interview with the Salt Lake Tribune, quote, "If it were their daughter, what would they want the parents to do? I would try to make it right," end quote. Meanwhile, police continued to do what they could without a confession or forensic evidence.
Cadaver dogs were walked through Spanish Fork Canyon, and detectives secured the ground, and detectives scoured the ground, both on and off the trails. But they never came across any sign of Kipling's remains.
Was there anything that they were possibly able to do?
Sadly, no. In 2003, increased by what essentially a written accusation from Timmy, a grand jury investigation began. Hundreds of people were subpoenaed to testify, including classmates, family members, and friends of the three boys central to this investigation. Over the next 2 years, leading into the 10-year anniversary of Kipling's disappearance, The grand jury heard everything from conjecture to timelines and damning evidence, which was all new. Like, it was shocking how much students had concealed over the years. And actually, one woman claimed that she saw Rucker threaten Timmy in the aftermath of the written account that he had given before, explaining that Rucker gave him strict instructions not to bring his name up in the investigation again, and that Chris's ex-wife also came forward with an incriminating piece of evidence. She remembered that they had been watching the movie So I Married an Axe Murderer, when she playfully asked him, quote, "What's the worst thing you've ever done?" end quote. His response was,
"Don't say it.
What if I told you I killed Kipling Davis?"
"You are joking."
"I wish." But his ex-wife said Chris immediately walked back his statement and just like that, "Oh, I was just kidding about that."
Why would anybody joke about killing somebody that is missing?
Yeah, like that's such a scary thing to say.
Like, even if he wasn't anywhere close to this investigation, to say that, like,
it's weird.
It is. It's so weird. It makes no sense.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, another account came from when Kipling's case was discussed at a party. Timmy actually admitted that he knew exactly where her body was and that he had killed her, along with the help of two others. Timmy apparently even added that she got what she deserved. But he was found to have made many shocking statements, which came forward at the inquest of the grand jury. Over the years, witnesses compiled, like, he was apparently bragging, saying, quote, "I know that f***ing bitch. I killed her," end quote. Another time, he apparently said, quote, "I took her, I beat her, I killed her, and disposed of her body," end quote.
So, as disturbing as everything that was just spoken, do the police believe that it was legit, or are they just making up these statements?
Honestly, I'm not too sure. But he apparently called a friend and asked to stay with the friend's house because the FBI was descending upon him, knowing that Timmy had killed her. He allegedly said, quote, "I did it. I did it. I raped and killed Kipling Davis," end quote. He later told a group of people at a gathering and, referring to his cohort, said, quote, "We all know who did it. We all did it," end quote. A local woman also claimed that Timmy told her he was involved.
I mean, okay, let's discuss some stuff really quick. Okay, number one, we know polygraphs don't mean crap.
Literally.
Don't we mean know anything. That. But he has said so much that I don't know how they couldn't go off of that right there. I mean, literally at that given point, with all these witnesses that had compiled, everything else, everybody coming with multiple people saying this and things of that nature, why can we not arrest them?
Right.
I mean, it just... it doesn't make no sense.
Right. So he also told the woman that he had buried Kiplin in the sand and told her almost with like a hint of remorse, as if he had any. He said, quote, "It was an accident. We didn't mean to. She's cold. She's alone. She's up in the train trestles and they need to go get her," end quote.
As the jurors would learn, it wasn't just Kiplin who had fallen prey to Timmy's treatment of women. By his mid-20s, he had been married twice, and both of his wives claimed that he had been physical with them. The grand jury also revealed that Timmy had once gotten into an altercation with a woman about what happened to Kiplin and had even punched her in the stomach, shoved her into a wall, and forced her into his vehicle. He then drove her to Spanish Fort Canyon. You remember the place that we've been talking about? And he raped her, which is very eerily similar to what they believe happened to Kiplin the day she disappeared. He also came onto another woman, and when she had turned him down, he hit her in the head with a flashlight.
There's also examples of him confessing and hurting women. It seemed as if Timmy had pointed his finger at Rucker all of those years to get blame off of him. Like we said, Rucker and Chris both passed their polygraph tests.
Do we think it's a good possibility that they could have helped Timmy cover it up?
I mean, there's a possibility. I feel like that could be what happened. I just feel like maybe it was sexually motivated, and that maybe she rejected him, so he decided to rape her and then kill her. Honestly, I'm not too sure, but it wouldn't shock me if that's what happened. I do believe that all three of them were involved. I mean, when it comes to who killed Kiplin, maybe it was one, maybe it was two. I mean, it could have been all three of them.
I know what I'm thinking, but I need confirmation of what you're thinking. Do we think they're innocent?
Oh, God, no. And, I mean, neither does the law. Chris Rucker and Timmy were all charged with lying to law enforcement. Timmy was found guilty on 15 counts of perjury and was sentenced to 12 and a half years in prison. Chris was sentenced to 5 years and Rucker was sentenced to 4. Chris and Timmy were also charged with first-degree murder in May of 2009. Chris was found guilty on obstruction of justice and pleaded no contest. In February of 2012, Timmy somewhat accepted responsibility, claiming that he witnessed Kiplin's murder.
Did he say who did it?
Oh God, no. Timmy did say that Kiplin had been knocked down and then hit with a rock. Later, the three boys return, removing her body and placing it in another location where her body remains today. But of course, Timmy would talk, but he wouldn't say where this place was. Probably because it would officially prove that he was possibly the ringleader of the crime. He pleaded guilty to manslaughter charges, a 15-year sentence, to be served concurrently with his perjury charges, and aimed to the flurry of arrests and appealing information that was coming out. The only thing that Kiplin's family cared about was bringing her home. And they weren't even being given that small piece of, like, peace.
According to Richard, he pleaded with the central figures in his daughter's disappearance, saying, quote, "I just asked him, please, Timmy, just tell me where she is. I'll be your biggest advocate, if you will. I'll help you in any way I can. All I want to do is bring her home. Just tell me where she is," and he didn't, end quote.
Timmy has refused to reveal where Kiplin's body is concealed to this day. Richard said, quote, "What about the sleepless nights my family has gone through about where Kiplin's body is? Why can't Timmy just show us and bring us peace to our family? All of our family wants to bring Kiplin home to bury her in a proper place," end quote. But through his lawyer, Timmy said, quote, "I've done everything I can. I take responsibility. There's nothing else I can do. There's nothing else I can provide that would change the situation."
I know he did not just say that.
It's so frustrating, right?
It's so frustrating to know that her family is saying, "We will advocate for you. We will do this. Just tell us where our daughter and our sister is so we can properly bury them. But this little does not want to give this family any type of peace whatsoever.
And Richard actually ended up writing a book titled When an Angel Leaves Your Life. And the proceeds from this book contribute to a scholarship fund, which the book was actually one of the main resources for this episode. Timmy was up for parole in 2012, but it was denied on the grounds that he had not acted in good faith by revealing the location of Kipling's body, despite having admitted to committing the crime.
His release date is February 10, 2026, which is only 4 months away. Richard said, quote, "If it takes the rest of my life to find Kipling, I'll do it," end quote. Kipling was about 5'3" tall and weighed about 110 pounds when she was missing. She had blue eyes and curly red hair. On the day she was missing, she was wearing dark jean shorts, a white crew neck, and a light blue jean vest with beige stripes on it, along with two silver rings.
If you have any information on the disappearance of Kipling Davis or the whereabouts of her remains, please call the Spanish Fork Police Department at 801-804-4500. We'll be back next week with a new episode. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find a good West Virginia true crime podcast.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. Also YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.